The title of today's sermon is Depression. I am going to be speaking on depression, and we'll be speaking on it, as always, from a biblical point of view. Depression is something that's not understood, but the Bible, without using that word depression, speaks a great deal about subjects such as depression and discouragement. God's people go through a lot of horrible trials, sometimes desperation and despair. We use the word despondency sometimes. Despondency means a total lack of hope. Brethren, as we begin today, let's go to 1 Kings, and we'll read 1 Kings 18 and 1 Kings 19 as the experiences of Elijah. And Elijah suffered what we would call today depression, and we can see how God dealt with it and how God had Elijah deal with it, because Elijah's depression is typical. It strikes him just without warning in the wake of his, with the Bible, as far as the details that we have, the biggest success that Elijah ever had. So let's begin, and we'll read this in context, just to get a good feeling of how things are going and so forth. Let's begin in 1 Kings 18. We'll get to know Elijah and his circumstances a little bit better. We've touched on the stories of Elijah and Ahab, and the fact that God caused the rain, to cease. Well, this is 3.5 years, as we begin chapter 18, 1 Kings 18. This is 3.5 years after the rain has stopped. And brethren, you'd have to try to imagine what it would be like. I know that for myself, in the summertime, if around August, maybe sometimes July, if we haven't put the watering system on the grass begins to turn brown and dry up. You can imagine how dry it would be after the end of 1 year with no rain, and 2 years with no rain, and 3 years with no rain, and going into the fourth year, the only place you would even be able to find any kind of grass growing would be, maybe in what had previously been a swamp or along riverbanks or someplace where there's a source of water, because God had dried up the heavens. So that's where we come into the story. Let's begin in chapter 18 and verse 1. And it came to pass after many days, this is at 3.5 years, that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, go show yourself unto Ahab. Well, to a large extent, Elijah had been doing his best to stay out of Ahab's sight, because Ahab was a very dangerous man. And I will send rain upon the earth. God's the one that does it. We have no part in that, brethren, except that when we praise God, keep his commandments, and are obedient, God does send blessings. That's our part, but God has the control. Verse 2, and Elijah went to show himself unto Ahab. And there was a sore famine in Samaria. Samaria is that country north of Jerusalem and going up through what we call the land of Israel. And Ahab called Obadiah. Obadiah means servant of God, if you were to translate that into English. And Ahab called Obadiah, which was the governor of his house. Now, Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. So Obadiah is a good guy. Verse 4. For it was so, when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord, that Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water. So now picture this. Obadiah is the governor. That means he kept the checkbook and the accounts and so forth for Ahab and Jezebel, but he did not follow the command of Jezebel to destroy the prophets of God. That is, we obey a civil rule when it's within God's laws and within God's ways. But when it goes contrary to what God says to do, then we're obedient to God. And Obadiah understood that. And so he knew where a couple of caves were, and they must have been pretty good sized caves to put 50 of the true prophets in. And he put them in there, and he took care of them. He fed them, and he brought them water and so forth. And so he was giving them asylum, they were in a protection plan. So I guess a witness protection plan, so that Ahab and Jezebel couldn't kill him. Verse 5, Ahab said unto Obadiah, go into the land, into all the fountains of water, everywhere you know that there's a spring and so forth, and into all the brooks. Peradventure we may find grass to save the horses and the mules alive, that we lose not all the beasts or the animals. And so Ahab certainly wanted to keep his horses that pulled chariots, his war-making animals and so forth, alive. And you could imagine that a great many of the livestock perished in this famine. And so they divided the land between them to pass throughout it. Ahab went one way by himself, and Obadiah went another way by himself. It's interesting that Ahab did not commit this job to a lesser servant, but it was so important that he went looking to decide for himself whether there was sufficient grass for his animals or not. Verse 7, and as Obadiah was in the way, behold, Elijah met him, and he knew him, and he fell on his face and said, art thou that my Lord Elijah? Read that very closely, my Lord Elijah. So Obadiah is saying to Elijah, I respect your position. I know that you're a prophet of God. You are my master, Elijah. Well, Elijah is not real sure about that. Verse 8, and he answered him, I am. Go tell thy Lord, behold, Elijah is here. So there's a little bit of a retort there. Elijah says, in effect, I'm not the one that you're answering to. You're answering to Ahab. And you're not really answering to me. So Elijah is saying, okay, let's set the record straight about, who's serving who here. Now, remember, we know that Obadiah is a servant of God and worships the true God. Verse 9, and he said, what, have I sinned that thou wouldst deliver thy servant into the hand of Ahab to slay me? So you notice he comes back and he refers to himself. Obadiah refers to himself as thy servant again. So he turns the table back on Elijah, puts himself in service to Elijah by saying, thy servant into the hand of Ahab to slay me. As the Lord thy God lives, there is no nation or kingdom whither my Lord hath not sent to seek thee. So Ahab has been looking for Elijah. Ahab would really like to get rid of Elijah once and for all and be done with him. And he's put out a manhunt through, every county, there's no borders to stop where the manhunt went. Continuing in the middle of verse 10. And when they said, he's not here, he took an oath of the kingdom and the nation that they found you not. They had to swear. I swear I don't know where Elijah is. That's how hard Ahab was looking for him. Verse 11. And now thou sayest, go tell thy Lord, behold, Elijah is here. So Obadiah is putting the words back in Elijah's mouth, saying, Elijah, you're asking too much of me to go back and tell my master, Ahab, that I found Elijah. Obadiah is saying, look, I know better than that. I'm not going to fall for something like that. Now, here's what was on Obadiah's mind. He says, here's what will happen. And it shall come to pass, as soon as I am gone from thee, that the Spirit of the Lord shall carry thee whither I know not. And so when I come and tell Ahab, and he cannot find thee, he shall slay me. But I, thy servant, Elijah, fear the Lord from my youth. So Obadiah is appealing to Ahab. Please don't make me tell Ahab where you are. Because you won't be here. You don't have any control, Elijah, of where you are. God just comes and whisks you away to do God's business. But I'm going to get caught between a rock and a hard place, and I'll be dead. And God will be using you somewhere else. Verse 13. was it not told, my Lord? Okay, what? So Obadiah is saying, Elijah, didn't you hear what I, Obadiah, did to the prophets? Was it not told, my Lord, what I did when Jezebel slew the prophets of the Lord, how I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water? So Obadiah, he's not bragging. He's giving a little evidence of his faithfulness to God and his ways. And now thou sayest, go tell thy Lord. It's really eating on Obadiah. It just gets repeating this over and over what Elijah said. You know, you're calling Ahab my Lord. Behold, Elijah is here and he shall slay me. So he's repeating himself. And Elijah said, as the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself unto him today. So Obadiah is happy with that because Elijah has given his word that indeed he will meet with Ahab. And so Obadiah, verse 16, went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. Verse 17, it came to pass, when Ahab saw Elijah, that Ahab said unto him, art thou he that troubles Israel? These men could really send some stinging jabs back and forth. It's just the way that they talk. They put everything on the line. There's an efficiency of words here. It says an awful lot. And of course, Elijah's not going to take that off of Ahab. And he answered, I have not troubled Israel, but thou, you Ahab, thou and thy father's house, in that you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and thou hast followed Balaam. Now, brethren, we have to understand that these people were doing horrible things. This following Balaam required cruel child sacrifices and magic and ritual fornication, you know, that wars against the family. And they were trying to force God and the gods of the land to do anything. This was a horrible culture that Ahab had. And so they're the ones that troubled Israel, is the way that Elijah is saying it to Ahab. Verse 19. Now therefore send and gather to me all Israel into Mount Carmel. You get everybody to Mount Carmel that you possibly can. All the Israelitish citizens of the nation. This isn't a conference of just the higher ups and the prophets. This is get everybody, all the people there, including the prophets, we'll see. Gather to me all Israel into Mount Carmel and the prophets of Baal. So the prophets of Baal also, 450 of the prophets of the groves, 400 which eat at Jezebel's table. So these were the real muckety-mucks of their religious system. There, 400 of them must have been right there at their headquarters, and they were the most important ones, and another 50 came in from out of town, I suppose. And get them all together over here at Mount Carmel. Verse 16, so Ahab sent to all the children of Israel, this must have taken a little while, and gathered the prophets together into Mount Carmel. Verse 21, and Elijah came unto all the people and said, how long halt ye between two opinions? Now, brethren, sometime when you're doing a little Bible study, you might want to look up this word halt. How long halt ye between two opinions? And it doesn't mean halt like we say halt or stop in the name of the law. Halt, to stop. This means to jump back and forth. We might say straddle the fence, but it goes much further than that. This is almost, as we go through here, you'll see it's almost like a rain dance, if you've ever seen any kind of a rain dance where you jump on one foot and then you jump on the other foot a couple of beats. But it had to do with their syncretism, being in one false religion and then taking the name of God also. How long halt ye, jump back in for teeter-totter between two opinions? If the Lord be God, follow him. But if Baal, you know, the ellipsis is, if Baal is God, then follow him. Of course, Elijah is about to have a big showdown, and he's about to call them on it. And he's making them, we used to say, put their money where their mouth is. He's setting them up so that they're not able to back out of this. I'm sure that when 450 of them were coming to Mount Carmel, they were saying, "You know, just let me have a piece of Elijah. I'm going to show him, you know, how the cow ate the cabbage." And you know, there's 450 of us. We must be right. There's only one of him. He must be wrong. But Elijah sets it up, and this verse 21 really tells the story. If the Lord be God, follow him, but if Baal, then follow him. And the people answered him not a word. They didn't say anything. And then said Elijah unto the people, I only remain a prophet of the Lord. And he's saying he's the only prophet. Now, I'm not sure at this point in Elijah's life why he is saying that. He just had this conversation with Obadiah where he knows there's a hundred of them hidden away. He might say, I'm the only one, or I'm the main one, or I'm the one that God's using right now. He says, I only remain a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let them therefore give us two bullets. So he requires of those men, you get two really fine bulls that are suitable for sacrifice. And they knew not to get a bull that had a blemish or was lame or maimed in any way. And let them choose one bullet for themselves and cut it in pieces and lay it on the wood and put no fire under it. And I'll dress the other bullet and lay it on wood and put no fire under it. Well, that's a pretty big job in itself. Today, we don't think of the role of priesthood being as dirty and grubby and difficult as it was. But I have never dressed a bull. I've gutted and stripped and cleaned a few deer. That's about the biggest animal that I've ever done. And that turns into some real work. A bull, I don't even know if you can roll a bull over by yourself. So it was quite a job, but Elijah, you know, he put himself to work, and he started doing the same thing. Verse 24, Elijah speaking to those false prophets, and call ye on the name of your gods, in the King James Version, that's little g, because Elijah's not about to give any credence to the Balaam. And I will call on the name of the Lord, and the God that answereth by fire, let him be God. So this will settle it. Not that God will become God at that point, but this will determine who the real, true God really is. And all the people answered and said, it is well spoken. You got a deal. Here's going to be a true test. There's going to be 450 of the prophets of Baal just praying and dancing and calling fire down. And I guess each one of those prophets would have known and said in his heart, I can't do it. But, you know, the other 449 can't be wrong. And all of us did together, kind of like we say, brethren, the effectual prayer of a righteous man avails much. I think these false prophets were thinking, okay, there's got to be a guy in here with the power and stuff. And so we're certainly going to win out over Elijah. He looks pretty tame over there by himself. Verse 25, and Elijah said unto the prophets of Baal, choose you one bullock for yourself and dress it first, for you are many, and call on the name of your gods and put no fire under it. And they took the bullock which was given them, and they dressed it, and they called on the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, oh, Baal, hear us. But there was no voice, nor any that answered. And they leaped. Now that word leaped there, brethren, that's the same as that word halt that we saw across the page. How long? Halt ye between two opinions. They leaped upon the altar. They're limping kind of on one foot and jumping on the other. You know, I've never seen this, but as you study into it, it was the best thing I could think of is when I've seen a rain dance and you know, those dances to pagan gods, and I'm sure there was some kind of background music going on in everything. And they leaped upon the altar which was made. And it came to pass at noon that Elijah mocked them. Now this is a little bit strange because we try to teach people not to make fun of people who don't know the truth. Elijah is in a showdown with these false people who, if their gods prevail, Elijah will be the next one to get killed. And he mocks them and said, "Cry aloud, for he is a god," with little g. "Either he is talking," and that word is more like meditating or being contemplative, "or he is pursuing," and that word there, if you look it up in the Hebrew and study it a little bit, he's really mocking them. He's kind of saying maybe he had an answer because he's making a potty stop somewhere. That's what that word means. "Or he's on a journey or peradventure he's asleep and needs be awakened." So that's what he was saying. He was saying to them, in effect, "Your God is no God." I guess that would probably be the true meaning of mocking. And he's really mocking their false God is what he's doing, what they stand for. Verse 28. I'm sure he didn't violate the principle that we try to follow, where you love the sinner but hate the sin, and try to make that distinction. But at this particular time, there's no way for him to show love to these false prophets, because they will not hear and they will not turn, and their whole lives are wrapped up in their jobs, eating at Jezebel's table. You could imagine what happened if any one of those would turn to the true God. Not only would he not eat at Jezebel's table, he would be cut off, as it says back there in, where was it? In verse 4, 18 and verse 4, Jezebel cut off the prophets. That would be a terrible thing. It would be the end of their lives. Verse 28, "And they cried aloud, and they cut themselves after their manner with knives." It's that barbaric kind of thing that you would picture Aborigines or somebody without a knowledge of the truth to do. With knives and lances, until the blood gushed out upon him. So it was a horrible, bloody mess. They would think that would be pleasing to Baal. That's a satanic type ritual that they think, oh, this is something that's pleasing to their God. After all, they're into brutally killing children and human sacrifice and so forth. So they got to come close to that in trying to please their gods. Verse 29, "It came to pass when midday was past that they prophesied until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, that there was neither voice nor any answer nor any that regarded." None of the gods responded. Not a one of the gods, muttered or sputtered or sent fire down or anything. Verse 30. "And Elijah said unto all the people, come near unto me. And all the people came near unto him. And he repaired the altar of the Lord that was broken down." So there was an old altar there that had been used, in the regular worship of God, the true God. "And Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob." So he took 12 stones representing Israel. There is significance in what Elijah is doing here. Elijah's not just acting on his own. This is part of the covenant promise that God had with Israel being represented. So he took 12 stones according to the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, "Israel shall be thy name." And with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. And he made a trench about the altar as great as would contain 2 measures of seed. So he actually dug a ditch around the altar, through the dirt to the outside, made a little levee, I imagine. And he stacked the wood in order, and he cut the bullock in pieces, and he laid him on the wood and said, "Fill 4 barrels of water." And stop and think, it hadn't rained in 3.5 years. Water is about as precious as anything at this particular time, but Elijah's going to be very liberal, very free with the water. He's going to wet this thing down, and everybody knows that wet wood can't possibly burn. So he pours these 4 barrels of water over his sacrifice and his fire and his wood. There's no fire yet. and on the wood. And he said, do it again. Do it a second time. And they did it a second time. He said, do it a third time. He was really driving the point home. This stuff is wet. Now, everybody would have to be saying, okay, it's wet enough, it's wet enough, it's wet enough. But he's saying, look, he says, I'm giving you guys some points. You know, when people bet on a football game, they'll say, I'll take that team and I'll give you so many points. Well, he's giving them some points. They got to use dry wood and use 450 prophets. He's going to use wet wood, and pray to the true God. Verse 35, the water ran around the altar, soft and wet, and he filled the trench also with water. And it came to pass at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice. Again, brethren, this is timed so that it takes place. This offering to God takes place at the time when the true God is being worshipped or would be worshipped at the evening sacrifice. That Elijah the prophet came near and said, Lord God of Abraham. Now, brethren, recently we had a sermon on the names of God. And so when Elijah is praying to God here, he says, Lord, that's Yahweh. It's in all caps. God of Abraham, that's Elohim of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. Let it be known this day that thou art God in Israel, and that I am thy servant, and that I have done all these things at your word, at thy word. Elijah is not taking the credit, even though he says, I'm the only one, and so forth, that he's doing what God said. He's doing it God's way. God's told him to do it this way. And how God told him to do it, I don't exactly know, but, you know, God's the one that told Elijah to go on up and see Ahab. Verse 37. And this is part of a prayer. Hear me, O Lord, hear me, that this people may know that thou art the Lord God, and that thou hast turned their heart back again. Now, this is the Elijah work, to turn the hearts of the people to their God. And we see more of that in Malachi and so forth. But these people have turned to Balaam. The children of Israel have turned to Balaam. They don't know the true God. Brethren, this world doesn't know the true God. But Elijah is praying that all of this will have the effect that these people, their heart turns to God. Now, Elijah was a man who was very zealous, just like the people that we know in the Church of God. We are jealous, or the old King James used jealous. We would say zealous. We are zealous for God's way and God's truth and the gospel being sent to the world. We want people to know the truth. We want people to turn from their pagan ways and to know the truth. It's our life's work. It's what we hope and pray for. And that's what Elijah wanted. He wanted that these people's hearts be turned to the true God. Verse 38. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. It just ate up everything. I don't know if it was like lightning or like if it was like that pillar of fire that the Israelites followed. But whatever this was, it didn't just come down and kind of cook the meat medium or rare. It just totally sizzled and fried and consumed even the stones and dried up the water in the ditch. If you've ever gone over and looked at dirt after a fire had been there the day before, you know, it just has all the moisture baked completely out of it. This was just powder dry. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces. Notice all these people. We're up here with a bunch of Israelites. All these people fell on their faces and they said, the Lord, He is the God. The Lord, He is the God. And so, now these people were superstitious, you know, and they'll go with whatever's working, but they've been witnessed to, and they've heard the gospel, and they know who the true God is. And Elijah said unto them, take the prophets of Baal, let not one of them escape. And so these people, now they're following Elijah. He, they're the servants of Elijah, like Obadiah said, I am thy servant. These people, this is the way they understood business in those days. And he said to them, let not one of them escape. And they took them. And Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon, and they slew them there. So you talk about a mess, 450 dead prophets. That's a horrible lot of dead prophets. And Elijah said unto Ahab, notice Ahab isn't dead. He's the king. He's the ruler of Israel. get thee up, eat and drink. Now Elijah tells Ahab to eat and drink, but there's no evidence that Ahab eats or drinks, Elijah eats or drinks here, but Ahab does. For there is a sound of abundance of rain. Now, I don't know what that means, a sound of abundance of rain. I wrote in my margin thunder. That's the only sound I know that's associated with rain. I know at night, as a little boy, before we had Doppler radar, I can remember lightning way off in the distance on a summer evening, and you just see it flash on the tops of the clouds, and it must have been 40 miles away or something, and you wouldn't hear the thunder. Now, I suppose if you listen very, very carefully, you know, maybe 2-3 minutes after you saw the flash, that maybe you'd hear just a real slow rumble if everything was perfectly quiet. And I think that's what he did. He could hear thunder way out at sea, but he couldn't see anything yet. So Ahab went up to eat and to drink. So we know that King Ahab did. And Elijah went to the top, on top of this Mount Carmel, and he cast himself down upon the earth, and he put his face between his knees. Look, this has been a big day. Now, Elijah is his own, I don't want to sound trite, but on a real super high. I mean, God has answered his prayer. He's shown this nation that he's God. This has got to be the biggest, most fantastic day of Elijah's life. All the prophets of Baal are dead. The true God is being worshipped. He's revealed. He's seen these tremendous miracles unfold right before his eyes. And Elijah was certainly moved, a very emotional high, spiritual high, however you want to put it, verse 43. And said to his servant, and his servant was with him, go up now, look towards the sea. And he went up and he looked and he said, there's nothing. And he said, go again seven times. So Elijah must be in a position where he can't actually see, or maybe there's some kind of big rock at the tip top that his servant could climb up on. But seven times he goes up there, and it came to pass the seventh time that he said, behold, there arises a little bitty cloud out of the sea. It's just one little bitty old cloud out there is all I see. I hadn't seen clouds for 3.5 years with any rain in them. And he sees a little cloud out there. It's like a man's hand, just a little one. And he said, go up, say unto Ahab, prepare the chariot and get thee down, that the rain stop thee not. So Elijah is telling Ahab what to do. This is King Ahab, but Ahab is in a listening mood with all of this going on. And he says, look, you better get out of here when you can. The sky is going to be lowering. The weather is going to be such that you can't travel. You better get out as soon as you can. Verse 45, it came to pass in the meanwhile that the heaven was black with clouds and wind, and there was a great rain. And we've seen those come in. We've seen rains come in to where it just blocks out the sun and gets almost black. You turn on your lights, cars pull off the side of the road because you can't drive. It's one of those kind of real, real hard rains. And Ahab rode and he went to Jezreel. So he did get out of there. Now it's interesting. Stop and think of Elijah. Elijah is the prophet of God to these people, to Israel and everything. Elijah might be under the impression that God is beginning a new thing with Israel. Maybe God is showing Israel something that Elijah has not seen in his lifetime. Maybe the gospel is going to go to all of northern Israel here. Maybe the people will start to worship the true God and put away their altars and tear down the groves. Maybe they'll even come to Jerusalem for the feast, not in the fall, but at Passover 3 times in a year. A new day is beginning. Maybe that's what Elijah's thinking. And Elijah's, I don't know why we do this, but I picture Elijah as a crusty old a prophet with a long beard that he could almost trip over, being kind of crotchety and old, maybe walking with a stave. I guess we do that because of European art from the time of the Renaissance or something. But Elijah is not like that. Elijah is young. He's fit. He's in shape. He's able to run a marathon. And look at what he does, verse 46. And the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he girded up his loins, and he ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. We've seen those little cartoons where somebody puts you in an elevator, and then they run up the stairs, and when you get to the top, they try to take a deep breath, and the elevator doors open, and the same person that you said goodbye to on the first floor is waiting for you at the top floor. Well, Elijah pulls one of those. He's in Jezreel waiting for Ahab when he gets there, even though Ahab had a chariot and horses and everything. And maybe Elijah was prideful, but the scriptures don't say that. I would rather think that Elijah was hoping for a reformation that's not going to be, by the way. It wasn't in God's plan. But Elijah has seen this great work of God, and he probably thought and hoped that this work of God would go forward, and that people would say, here comes Elijah, here comes the prophet of God. You know, I almost hear that Budweiser theme in the background. You know, here comes the one, the big number one. You know, I don't know if Elijah is thinking that or not, but he comes hauling into town thinking, boy, we're going to preach the gospel and everything. Unfortunately, Jezebel is thinking something else. I don't know if Jezebel gets the full flavor of what's happened. Ahab was there. He saw these prophets of Baal trying all day long, to call fire down, and it really comes home to roost on Ahab that there's something big going on. But when he gets there, I don't think he quite tells his wife how marvelous it all was. I think he just gets there and says, you know, all those guys that worked for you, they're all dead. And it was Elijah that did it. Let's go to chapter 19 and verse 1. And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and without he had slain all the prophets with the sword. I think that's the emphasis. It said, sure, he told her all that he'd done. He made some fires and so forth. Or he made the wood piles and so forth, and the fire came down. But the main thing is he had slain all the prophets with the sword. Verse 2, then Jezebel sent a messenger unto Elijah, saying, so let the gods, little g, so let the gods do to me and more also, you know, let me be dead too, you know, if I have anything to do with it. If I make not thy life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time, you know, I think that's where they get that for the cowboy shows. This town ain't big enough for both of us. You got 24 hours to get out of town. So she says, you got to get out here by tomorrow this time. Verse 3, and when he saw that, he arose, and he went for his life, and he came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. Now, see, we're way, way up here at Jezreel. We're way, way up north. I don't know how far it is. I think it's over 100 miles. It's a long way up there. And he goes all the way down to Beersheba, and he left his servant there. I don't know if the servant wanted to stop or what. We don't have any details on that. Maybe the servant was slowing him down, or maybe he felt he was safe or whatever. Verse 4, but he himself, Elijah, went a day's journey into the wilderness, and he came and he sat down under a juniper tree. There must be some significance to the fact that it's a juniper tree. If anyone has anything on that, I'd like to see it. And he requested for himself that he might die. Okay, Elijah, after this great victory, being on this great high and everything, has lapsed into depression. He wants to die. He's saying, you know, I don't deserve to live. I don't want to live. He, all of a sudden, something has happened, whether it's physical, whether it's emotional, whether it's psychological. Elijah requested for himself that he might die. He may have even thought about taking his own life. He may have been suicidal, but that's how discouraged he was. That's how despondent, without hope he was. He feared for his life. He looked, Jezebel, she's one of these Canaanite God worshiping little g, worshiping people, that kills babies and people, and she's horribly cruel and mean. She's not a sweetheart. Don't picture any kind of queen that you've ever seen with a tiara and a beautiful gown, you know, doing the queen's wave in a parade. Don't think of that when you think of Queen Jezebel. You think of somebody brutal with a, like an axe murderer or something. That's the kind of woman Jezebel was. She was no lady. And Elijah knew that she had the power to kill him. He wouldn't be safe anywhere. He'd have a tremendous bounty on his head. And so he sunk into depression and he said, "It's enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life." He just told God, that's it, right? I mean, he felt worthless. You know, he felt disappointment. It didn't work out like he thought. Everybody didn't embrace the true God. He despaired. He just went over the top. Everything became dark and dismal. He sank into a terrible depression. And he says, "For I am not better than my fathers." Well, what had his fathers done? You know, his fathers were all dead, and they had not restored the truth to Israel either. Verse 5. "And as he lay and he slept under a juniper tree, behold, then an angel touched him and said unto him, 'Arise and eat.'" The Bible has given us some details here. Sometimes when people are depressed, they can't sleep. Their sleep patterns change. Sometimes they sleep all day and all night. So we see that he's sleeping under this tree, and an angel wakes him up. So maybe he's sleeping too much. And he looked, and behold, there was a cake baking on the coals and a cruse of water at his head. Now, one of the things that affects depression is nourishment, nutrition, diet. Now, the last time that Elijah has eaten, according to these scriptures, has been a good long time. He did not eat, according to these scriptures, when Ahab ate. That was way back when they were on at Carmel, before they went to Jezreel. And Ahab went all the way there, and now he's gone all the way down south. And so maybe there's some deficiency that's causing him to have some difficulties too. But one thing we would know is that if an angel, a messenger of God, says, "Here, eat this," the angel is giving to Elijah what is right for him to eat. The angel's certainly not going to give him something that, you know, if he needs a protein, the angel's not going to give him a carbohydrate or vice versa. The angel gives him what he needs, and he did eat, and he drank, and he laid him down again. So, it takes a little while for food to work, but he's ready to go back to sleep. And the angel of the Lord came again the second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for thee." Okay? It's not too far, it's too hard, is what the matter is. It's too much of a trip to take, no more than you've had to eat, the kind of shape that you're in. The trip is too great for you. And so he arose and he did eat and he drinks again. And he went in the strength of that meal, that food, that meat, 40 days and 40 nights unto Horeb, the Mount of God. And so that's Mount Sinai. In fact, it's very interesting. We know the story of Moses down at Mount Sinai and how God gave him the Ten Commandments. And we know that there was a time when Moses went into a cave on Mount Sinai and the glory of God passed by Moses and so forth. Verse 9. "And he came thither unto a cave and he lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him and he said unto him, 'What doest thou here, Elijah?'" Now, I don't know if God's saying, "What are you doing here at Mount Horeb? What are you doing down here at Mount Sinai?" I could see Elijah in his mind and in his heart saying, "This is the Mount of the Lord. This is where God made the covenant with Israel. What better place, what more appropriate place to go in refuge?" But there might be something, this would also be a good Bible study, "What doest thou here, Elijah?" He might be saying, "What are you doing in this state of mind? What are you doing in this attitude, Elijah?" And he said, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, slain thy prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left. And they seek my life to take it away." Now, at this point, Elijah's telling himself, you know, everything was a waste. Everything he tried to do has come to not preaching to the Israelites and having them see the miracles has all come to nothingness. And I'm the only guy left. And so, you know, what's the use? We gave it our best shot. What more could you do? You never do that any works that great again. It's hopeless. It's useless. You can see the despondency, and despondency has to do with a total lack of hope. There's no way we can pull it off. It's useless. It's hopeless. That's what it means. And we can see that. Verse 11. And he, this is God said, go forth and stand in the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and a strong wind rent the mountains. Now, when the mountain is rent, when you break a mountain, that's a pretty strong wind. And break in pieces the rocks before the Lord. So this is something like a tornado. I've never seen wind break rocks, but tornadoes, you know, can break some pretty big stuff. But the Lord was not in the wind. Okay, we'll get a little understanding of that in just a minute. God was not in the wind. Yahweh, the eternal God, was not in that wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. I don't know if that's a little bit like a volcano, you know, back there at the time of Moses. And this would be an interesting Bible study to go back. Remember, Mount Sinai was all on the smoke, it said, back there in Moses' time. So there's something about Mount Sinai erupting or bursting forth with fire sometimes. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still, small voice. Now, that's kind of hard for us to understand. Was it a whisper? Was it very, very soft, very, very quiet? And it was so, when Elijah heard it, that real calm, quiet, gentle, still small voice, when he heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle. Now, I think that might have been out of a respect for God. And he went out and he stood in the entering of the cave. God had told him, to stand there. So we're in verse 13, brethren. And Elijah went out, and he stood in the entering of the cave. And behold, there came a voice unto him, and said, what doest thou here, Elijah? And he said again, brethren, verse 14, I've been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant and thrown down. Now he's repeating himself. Well, God repeating himself. God asking him again, what are you doing here, Elijah? He's not even in the same place, but he's in that same emotional state of mind the second time God asked him that. But God is showing Elijah something here. When Elijah gets through saying, you know, they've thrown down your altar, slain your prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left. And they seek my life to take it away. It almost sounds like there's some self-pity here, now. Elijah's kind of wallowing in his misery. And he's starting to feel, pretty bad. Some people don't like the phrase low self-esteem, but Elijah's sinking into this, depression. Now, What did we mean by God wasn't in the wind or the earthquake or the fire and so forth? Brethren, Elijah really liked it when God did that momentous act of sending the fire down and consuming the altar and the sacrifice and the stones and everything. But God doesn't work that way that often. We don't see these big bombastic miracles. You know, everybody believes in an instant when we see a big miracle. All Israel, they came and were, you know, doing Elijah's every bidding, you know, right there when it happened. But, you know, how long did they remain faithful to Elijah? How long did they really say, we're the servants of Elijah? You know, it was one big flash in the pan, And then Israel went right back to doing what they did before. I could see these Israelitish men going home to their wives all across the country, and their wives going, you know, and then still, you know, weeping for Tammuz and going back to their own little idols and everything the very next Sunday. God doesn't work in these big, flashy ways most of the time. God works quietly, behind the scenes, but he always brings his plan about. We don't see the workings of God. It seems like today, brethren, sure, we can look back over the last 50 years and say, obviously, God has worked. God has called out a faithful people. There are us brethren who know the truth and are living the truth with the help of God's Holy Spirit. But we haven't seen anybody walk on water. We haven't seen the dead raised back to life. And when God does heal, and God heals often, it seems like it took 2-3 weeks for people to get well. You know, God answers the prayers, but there's this thing of unfaithfulness in us, and well, they would probably got well anyway. A lot of people have been sick and got well. A lot of people got operated on and got well. A lot of people been burned and had skin grafts and got well. And so our carnal nature can easily rule it out. But God is like this still, small voice, faithful, true, quietly working behind the scenes, certainly always keeping his covenant promises and working things out and bringing it about. But Elijah has sunk into this despair, to this depression, this despondency, because things didn't work out. But what does God tell him to do? God says, Elijah, go back to work. That's what you need to do. You need to get back with the program. Verse 15, the Lord said unto him, go. Return on thy way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you come, anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. Well, Hazael did become the king, excuse me, the king of Syria. He replaced Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria. We're not going to go there today. You can read about that starting in 1 Kings chapter 20. But God gave Elijah this commission, go anoint Hazael. Well, Elijah delegated this authority to Elisha. And then there's some more directions given to Elijah, verse 16. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, shalt thou anoint to be king over Israel. Well, Ahab is still king over Israel right now at this point, but go anoint Jehu. You can follow this story out, but I believe the way that it worked is that Elijah gave the job to Elisha, who also delegated it to one of his disciples, but Jehu was anointed. It was done because God asked Elijah to do it. Elijah took care of it, and Jehu does become the king of Israel, as it says here. Verse 16, and Jehu the son of Nimshi shall you anoint to be king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah shalt thou anoint to be the prophet in thy room, or in your stead, to in your office. You can go over to 2 Kings 2 and read about that, brother. Verse 17, it shall come to pass that him that escapes the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay. So there's a battle there, because Hazael is over in Syria, and Jehu's the king of Israel. But anyway, God's saying, you know, look, if one doesn't take care of the problem, another will take care of the problem, and him that escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay. So God's will is going to be done. God's going to clean up what God's going to clean up. But Elijah, I want to talk to you about something. You've repeated this a couple of times. You go, I'm the only one, you know, and he's starting to bemoan this fact. God says, let me set you straight. Verse 18, yet I have left me 7,000 in Israel, all the knees which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which has not kissed him. So you're worried about Israel not hearing the truth and Israel turning to the true God. I've got 7,000 that never went after Balaam up there. So Elijah, you know, the work of God is not lost. You know, God knows where his people are. And brethren, it's even the same way for us today. You can read this in Amos. Not a seed falls to the ground that God's not aware of. God knows who we are, where we are, and he's keeping track of us. Verse 19. So he, Elijah, departed thence and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen. And the way I take this is that they were plowing in teams. There were 12 teams. I think there were 11 other men in Elisha. At least that's the way I take it. If somebody knows differently, please tell me. But I think they were plowing each with two oxen and there were 12 teams. But, Elisha, it was his form or his responsibility. Maybe it was still his daddy's form. I guess it was. Verse 19 in the middle. And he went with the 12, and Elijah passed by him and cast his mantle upon him. So he just flipped his mantle over him, and that's the way he anointed Elisha to take over in his stead. And Elisha, verse 20, he left the oxen and he ran after Elijah. It sounded like it was just almost done in passing. And he said, "Let me, I pray thee, kiss my father and my mother." You know, I got to say goodbye to my folks. Then I will follow thee. And Elijah said unto him, "Go back again, for what have I done to thee?" Now, I don't know what the intent is there. I don't know if Elijah's saying, "Yeah, I wasn't thinking. For sure, go back and say bye to your mom and dad." Or was he saying, "I'm not so sure I picked the right guy. If you're a whiny baby, you know, got to go back to your mom and daddy and say goodbye." I'm not sure what the intent is here. I think the latter. I think he's saying, "Well, go on back. You know, if that's what you got to do. What have I done to thee?" You remember the parable in Luke where it says, "Whoever put his hand to the plow, you know, don't look back." Or the other time when Jesus Christ offered the discipleship to one young man, and he says, "Well, I got to go back and bury my dad," meaning I got to go back and spend the last days of my dad's life. He might live a year or two, but after that, I'll come and serve you. You know, and Christ said, "Well, he really missed out on something." I think it's a little bit similar to that. But Elisha's on track. He returned back, verse 21, from Elijah, and he took a yoke of oxen, just two of them, and he slew them. I mean, here they were plowing a while ago, and he kills them, and he boils their flesh with the instruments of the oxen. So he took the plowing instruments, the yoke and all of that, that they don't need this anymore if we kill the ox, plural. And he gave it to the people, and they did eat. And so he had this big feast. Then he arose, and he went after Elijah and ministered unto him. So, God allows a lot of room for people to do things. You know, there would have been a time when ministers would have said, you go back, I don't want to see you again," or something like that. But it works out. And so that's the way that this whole thing went down. So we see, brethren, that Elijah's depression is just a typical type depression. It just strikes him without warning, right in the wake of his biggest success over these false prophets of Baal. That's what happened to Elijah. After, you know, tremendous victory like that, you'd think his enemies would finally give him some respect. At least they might leave him alone for a while, but it didn't work out that way. His great victory just made old hateful Queen Jezebel even more determined to hunt him down and to destroy him. And that, brethren, would certainly be enough to make any of us depressed. I mean, you know, we get depressed over things when people aren't trying to hunt us down and kill us, when it seems like bad things keep happening to us, no matter how hard we try, you know, we can get depressed too. But Elijah, he wasn't thinking clearly. You don't think clearly when you're depressed. He wasn't alone. You know, he wasn't the only one left in Israel. There were 7,000, you know, if he could see him. And part of the solution was, you know, he was fed by an angel of God. A couple of times, God told him to go back to work. Brethren, it's the same way with us. When we finally reach some goals that we set for ourselves in our lives, when we reach a major turning point in our lives. Often the result is not what we thought it would be. You know, for so many years, brethren, for so many of us, we were putting everything we had into the worldwide church of God, thinking this is where God is working, this is what God is doing. We had all the hopes that the church would grow big and large, that Jesus Christ would return to his church, which was that church, you know, and that we'd all go to the place of safety together, and oh, there would be a malcontent here or there, but the biggest majority of us would go that way, and we'd all end up, you know, in the promised land, so to speak, the place of safety. Well, you know, we got our bubble popped just like Elijah did. It didn't work out that way. Right? About the time that we thought things were going to get better, brethren, they did not get better. They became even worse. Brethren, there are two kinds of people. There are people who know what depression is, and there are people who don't know what depression is. I'm not being facetious, but depression is something that I think is hard to grasp. It's something that's difficult to be empathetic about. It'd be very easy for somebody that has never had depression or experienced depression or to really believe there is such a thing as depression. I could see somebody like that saying, oh, just shake it off, get over it, snap out of it. There's nothing to it. But there is something to it. God addresses it in a number of different ways. If we had time to go into them, there are times in the Bible when we can see that Moses was depressed. We might touch on that. Or Jonah. Jonah. You know, he went over to Nineveh. He got depressed. There's even Christ got pretty heavy laden a few times. Depression, brethren, is something that can happen to anybody. And if you've never suffered from depression, you don't know exactly what it is, but it's real. And perhaps this message will be helpful. And it doesn't happen just to weak-minded people. It might be a conclusion that somebody was, oh yeah, if you were strong of mind or had enough faith or whatever, you wouldn't have depression. Well, you know, I wish my faith were as strong as Elijah's and Moses' faith. Those were men of faith, and yet they suffered from depression. Abraham Lincoln, brethren, he suffered from terrible depression. He once wrote, "I am now the most miserable man living. Whether I shall ever be better, I cannot tell. I awfully forebode I shall not." And Abraham Lincoln's wife wondered if Abraham would even survive his grief. Abraham Lincoln suffered some terrible bouts of depression. Florence Nightingale suffered from depression. A great many people who made a great deal of their lives suffered from depression. One great man who suffered from depression was Winston Churchill. Churchill's depression showed itself most prominently whenever he suffered a political setback. You'll remember that he was jailed during World War I. Another time Churchill was taken ill, and there were rumors that he had a nervous breakdown. He recovered. He called his depression, he referred to it as the black dog. There are other people that said that it's buried beneath the castle of despair or something. You know, they take these analogies, and talk about how deep and dark and hopeless it is when you suffer depression. But, Winston Churchill had bouts of depression, you know, for his whole life, and they were particularly difficult at times of stress. Now, for anyone who studied the life of Winston Churchill, Winston Churchill grew up as a child in a very pessimistic environment. And when that kind of discouragement is common and encouragement is very rare, as in Churchill's case, a child like that can develop a vulnerability to depression. So depression is brought on by certain things. A depressed nature or depressive nature and feelings of being uncared for or unloved, go hand in hand. And Churchill, if you read his autobiography, it's very clear. Churchill thought he was unloved, and it was a reasonable supposition given that his parents neglected him and were disinterested in him. And he kind of said, you know, if I can't be loved, I'll find a way to be admired. And for Churchill, he compensated by being ambitious, and he was very ambitious. He became the Lord of the Admiralty again, because he had been watching Hitler, and he knew what was coming. And he went to work. You know, Churchill went to work working for the common good of the English people. And that helped Churchill in his daily battles against depression. You know, he had this big goal, win the war, put England back in a safe status. There are a lot of people these days that suffer from depression, brethren. And true Christians aren't exempt. They are not exempt from depression. It can come on anybody at any time. It can come on unannounced. Brethren, if you suffer from depression, I hope that some of this information is helpful. If you don't suffer from depression, then maybe what we're talking about today will assist you in understanding and helping those who do. But depression is real. Now, don't be fearful of depression, not in yourself. Don't be fearful of it in others. Even strong, mature Christians can suffer from depression. Depression is not a sign of a lack of faith or unbelief or a weak faith. It's often a symptom of stress. It's often a symptom of emotional battles or even spiritual battles. Sometimes a depressed person will worry whether or not he'll make it into the kingdom of God. And when they get down like that, all a person knows is that God exists. Elijah never doubted that God existed. But brethren, we are in a horrible world. We have our own Jezebels to deal with nowadays. The depravity of sin in this world can cause us to feel hopeless. You know, that's despondent and depressed as well. Depression can be a normal reaction to the adverse circumstances of life. It's one of the ways that our body and our minds react to those kind of circumstances, to those kind of stresses. It can also be a feeling that follows of the loss of a loved one or the loss of health due to an accident or illness or the loss of something that we consider valuable or important in our lives. People suffering from mild depression usually recover in a short period of time. But for others, brethren, recovery can be a much longer process. It's one of the most common. Depression is one of the most common emotional problems people experience. And it's not entirely emotional. It becomes physical. One has to do with the other. When someone is depressed, they feel sad. They feel discouraged. They feel an inability to get on the top of things, to take control of their lives. Matthew chapter 11. God recognizes, brethren, that life can be overwhelming. I think it's a time for us to mature in the church of God. People fail. We are not superhuman. We can succumb to sicknesses and illnesses and accidents and the cares of this world. But all the time, God's plan is being worked out. All the time, God's plan is on track. That still small voice of God is working. God is in control. He's at the control. Matthew chapter 11, verse 28. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden. What does that mean, heavy laden? It means overloaded. How do we become overloaded? We can become overloaded physically, emotionally heavily laden. Look at what God says. And I will give you rest. Verse 29. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me. For I am meek and lowly in heart. God says, I am empathetic. I can walk in your shoes. I know what you're going through. And you shall find rest until your souls, our lives. And God explains it. He says, my yoke is easy. My burden is light. And that's the way God wants us to look at it, turning to God. Despondency is a very, very strong word. It means an utter lack of hope. It means to despair. When life's pressures become too great, the highs and the lows can begin to escalate. When God made us, He made a miraculous creation. He gave man something that we'll spend our lives trying to really understand, control, and get a grip on. And that's our emotions. Every one of us has emotions that go up and they go down. When something is beautiful, when something is wonderful, when there's a blessed event, our emotions soar. They go up. And sometimes they go high. And when there is a loss, and all of us have grandparents who have died, or parents who have died, or lost loved ones, or lost friends, our emotions go low. That is the normal ebb and flow. The tides of our emotions are natural and normal, and God made. That's the way God meant for our emotions to work. We don't always feel great. We don't always feel bad. They go up and they go down. But life's pressures can be like a storm. And just like the waves of the sea become very great when the winds push on them. They go up so high they break. They go so low they tear into the beach and the bottom of the ocean. Our emotions are not supposed to go so high that they break or so low that they break. The deeper than normal low can bring about depression. There's a term that we have heard, brethren. It's manic depressive. That's somebody that's as high as a kite. When somebody is as high as a kite and on top of the world and staying up there, a crash is going to come. I'll give you an example. We are physical. We are human. We can't go on forever and ever on high. You can't run wide open forever and ever. Sure, maybe you could do like Elijah did, and if you were in great shape, run 15 or 20 miles from Mount Carmel over to Jezreel. Maybe you could do that, but you couldn't turn around and run back and then run back again. You run out of fuel. You run out of juice. I had the experience one time. It's rather mundane, but I was working on a tractor, and we were trying to change a piece of equipment. This tractor had a very difficult clutch, and I was working that clutch with my leg, which was turning into an exercise kind of like you see people do over at health shops. What do you call a health shop where people go and work out? A fitness center. And they push these weights back and forth. Well, I wasn't doing it for fun. I was working on this track, and I just kept pushing in on this clutch, and it was a very difficult clutch. And I pushed it in, and they'd say, hold it, push it in, hold it. And finally we got off. I got off the tractor and tried to walk and fell down. My leg had used up all available energy. It's the only time that I can ever remember that happening, but I was trying to tell my leg, take a step, and it just wouldn't go. I had used it all up. Well, our minds are like that. If we stay on a manic high for too long, you're going to crash. And if you go low, you can crash too. That's my term, crash. But God didn't make our emotions to stay eternally high or eternally low. Those kind of mood swings, those types of mood swings, it can bring about depression and despondency that can affect or even wreck our lives if we're not careful. There's a physical law that every force has an equal and opposite reaction or a counterforce. And so, brethren, we shouldn't be surprised when we have an emotional low following an emotional high. It's just the way we work. Let's go over to Corinthians, 2 Corinthians. God tells us, again, he points us back to the fact that we can be secure in God, that we can rest in God, as we saw over in Matthew 11 just a while ago. God came to the aid of Elijah. He was fed. He was directed what to do. God instructed him. God got Elijah's mind back on the big picture. God's in charge. God's working it out. After Elijah's dead and gone, God had turned it, turned it over to somebody else. The job that God was doing was going to take place. Somebody else would do the anointings and take place. 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 3. Chapter 1, verse 3. Blessed be God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies, that's good, and the God of all comfort, the God of all comfort, not some comfort, not a little comfort, the God of all comfort. So brethren, we have a God that we can turn to when we're depressed. I mentioned to you a while ago that Moses suffered some depression. You can put this in your notes. We're not going to go there. Numbers 11 and verse 15. Numbers 11 and verse 15. Moses said, I'm not able to bear all this people alone. It was more than he could handle. We all come to times in our lives, brethren, when we run up against things we can't handle. We would like to be Superman. We would like to say, I can take anything. And sometimes people, maybe mothers feel like their children, suck all the life out of them. Just suck them dry, pull them down, demand everything of them. Because a child naturally thinks, mama can do this, mama can do that. She can cook, she can wash, she can clean, she can answer my every demand. But mothers run out of fuel also. Moses, with all those Israelites, wasn't able to take care of all those people. Joshua, also, he asked the Lord, why'd you do this to us? Bring us over this Jordan. He wished he had stayed over in Egypt. That's in Joshua 7:7. We're not going to go there either, but it shows that he felt overwhelmed. Job experienced some of it. He cried that he was weary of life also, just like Elijah did. That's in Job 10. The psalmist, I think it was David, he said, my life is spent with grief. That's in Psalm 31 and verse 10. These are all areas that you can go study, brethren, at your leisure. Jeremiah rued the day that he was born. A number of God's prophets suffered from depression. Micah, he got to the point where he wailed that all good men have perished from the earth. That's in Micah chapter 7. When we are depressed, brethren, when someone is depressed, there's something that takes place. It's an all or nothing kind of thinking. I'm the only one, like Elijah said, this will never work. I've reached the bottom of my bucket. And it seems real. Our reality is where we are. I'll never survive. This is it. Crash and burn. That goes along with depression. So when a person is depressed, they often accentuate the negative and they dismiss the positive. That's the nature of being depressed. Elijah forgot for a while that it's God who calls the shots. And we're like that. God came back to him because he's the God of all comfort, and he didn't forsake him. We're like that, and we've all been through it, especially when we're adults. Now, depression can strike young people, and it can strike old people. Brethren, I'm going to make this a two-part message because there's just absolutely too much to cover. I'll talk a little bit more about the technical aspects of depression. What brings it about? Is it physical? Is it psychological? Is it emotional? What is it next time? But when we get depressed, we often get that all or nothing thinking. We accentuate the negative. I'll never get a job, and that comes when we get one more rejection letter. Or I'll never get better, when you're sick. You can get sick and get depressed. Or if you're in pain, if you have a backache or something like that, you can really get depressed. You don't think your back is hooked to your brain until you have a backache. I'll never get better. Or people will say, I'm trapped in this marriage. Nothing will ever change. Now, that's a dangerous position to be in. Or they'll never change when a friend disappoints them. Or like Elijah was kind of saying, nobody cares about me. I'm the only one. I'm the only one that's stuck with the plan. Everybody else has left it. That's why God had to come back and say, no, there's 7,000 others that are sticking with the plan. It's easy to say nobody cares about me when, you know, somebody neglects us. Brethren, in the same way it was wrong for Elijah, our all or nothing thinking is factually incorrect for us as well. Several rejections don't mean that we're unemployable. Normal healing includes some setbacks. It takes a while. We do get sick. We'll talk a little bit more next time about some of the physical reasons that depression comes on. People do change, but most people do so. They change very slowly. It takes a lot of time. And I don't care how well you're taken care of, sometimes you're going to feel neglected. Amazingly, just like Elijah, we sometimes become depressed after we've experienced a great high or success in our lives. Sometimes when somebody goes out and does a very successful campaign, he hits a low the next day. It's just the way waves, a sinusoidal wave, works. You know, it carries the volume over the top, but then there's going to be a valley the next day, following the high. So depressions can come after successes. Physical danger and emotionally volatile circumstances always create fear and depression, and we're all fearful. That's not a lack of faith. You know, if you're walking down the street and a big dog comes running at you, your adrenaline is going to make the hair on the back of your neck stand up. You know, things are going to heat up inside of you. Those are built into us. What Elijah needed, and what we do too when we're depressed, was we lose our perspective. I thought about naming this sermon 3D. Anybody's ever seen a 3D movie where you put on the glasses, you get a better perspective. You get a three-dimensional perspective. It was going to be a play on words, you know, depression, despondency, despair, or you know, using the, there are a few others besides those. But we need to have a perspective, and that perspective that we have to have is the big picture, to get God back in the big picture. Now, I'm not saying it's so simple just to go up to somebody that is suffering from clinical depression and say, oh, if you just got God back in your life, you know, you'd get all better. No, brethren, we'll talk next time a bit about the fact that maybe you do need a tranquilizer or a sleeping pill or even an antidepressant, because if the depression has come about as a result of chemical imbalances or malnutrition or anemia or menopause or postpartum depression. There are a lot of times that we need a lot of help. So don't go up to somebody and just say, oh, if you just get your eyes back on God, you know, everything would really work out, and you'd snap right out of this depression and everything. That's a lack of understanding about what's really going on with depression. Brethren, let's go to Isaiah chapter 61. And we'll start wrapping this message up for today. Brethren, major life changes and pressures, the philosophy that we understand and know, or what we believe, being enslaved to circumstances, a lot of those kind of things can bring on depressions in our lives. From very mild depressions, from just being a little bit sad, a little bit blue, all the way to becoming despondent. There are varying degrees of depression, and we'll go into a little bit more the clinical aspects and technical aspects the next time that we cover depression. Isaiah 61 in verse 6. There's some beautiful words here, and we're going to close with this concept of keeping our eye on the big picture. If we know that God's in charge, if we know He is that still, small voice that never leaves us or forsakes us, that's always there with us, brethren, that's something that will see us through. It's not going to make us snap out, but it'll see us through until we come out the other side of depression. Isaiah 61 and verse 6, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek." You know, not the powerful of this world, but to the meek or the weak. "He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted." We do despair. We do become despondent. We do become depressed, brokenhearted. "To proclaim liberty to the captives." We can be captives to our emotions, to our circumstances. "And the opening of the prisons to those that are bound." There's nothing that'll clamp down on you and bind you like depression to make you think that you're stuck and cannot go. Verse 2, Isaiah 61 and verse 2. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me," okay, verse 2, "to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord and the day of vengeance of our God." To who? "To comfort all that mourn." Those are people that are depressed. Jesus Christ is there. God Almighty is there. Verse 3, "to appoint unto them that mourn in Zion, to give unto them beauty for ashes, the oil of joy for mourning, the garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness." There's a good description of depression. Spirit of heaviness. "That they might be called trees." You know, stand up. You know, don't be down. Don't be knocked down by depression and despairing. "That they might be called trees of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that He might be glorified." Brethren, submission to life circumstances is really submission to God's will in our lives. We can go through depression. Just like God allowed Elijah and the others that we mentioned to go through depression, God can allow us to go through depression. But God's got that still small voice. If we submit to the circumstances we're going through, we're really submitting to God's will. God will see us through. God will bring us out on the other side. God's will is being worked out. God is in control. He knows us. He loves us. He's not going to forsake us. He's not going to let us have more than we can handle. We don't always see God at work. We wish we could. You know, even now in the church, it's not the big church that we thought. Just like Elijah, he thought that great work was going to be done, but it didn't work out the way he thought. It didn't work out the way we thought either. Brethren, we don't see how God works. He does things in very quiet ways. He works in lives that we may never know about. Because Elijah didn't see God act as he thought God should act, he became despondent. God wanted Elijah to see how he does that. God wants us to see how he does that. God pulls us out every time. And brethren, every time God pulls us out of a fix, we ought to be the stronger for it and say, when we find ourselves in a depressed mood, situation, or despondent, you know, where we feel like things are hopeless, we ought to say, God will see me through this. God wanted for Elijah to get his eyes off of himself and onto God. Get his eyes off of his own expectations. And brethren, that's what we have to do. You know, I expect we're going to do this. I expect we're going to do that. But God's, you know, doing something else. Let's put our eyes on God and see what he's doing. So the answer to overcoming depression is to get our eyes off of ourselves. In closing, brethren, let's go to John chapter 14. John chapter 14. The answer to coming out of depression, to overcoming depression, is to get our eyes off of ourselves and on to God's promises as revealed in His Word. Because God's promises in His Word are sure. They're true. They're absolute. God is a covenant keeper. He's going to keep His promises. Brethren, depression is real. It is something that God understands that we go through. And when we're depressed, when we're mortified, when we're crushed, God understands it. Jesus went through being crushed. John 14 and verse 27. Verse 27 in closing. Here's what God said to us. Brethren, when we feel down and out, when we feel depressed, peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. Not as the world gives, do I give to you. Do not let your hearts be troubled, nor let it be fearful.